morning. Thank you. How was your week? Great. Yeah, I know. I get it. We didn't all have the same experience this week, I'm sure. I know my week was busy, and I can't see these good folks sitting out here. So they're going to turn up the house lights just any second now. I'm quite confident of it. At least that's the way I'm hoping it's going to turn out. Say, listen, I know that that Mike said this already, but we have this Philippine trip coming up where we'll leave on June 30th and return on July 12th. In order to get that many people on the same plane at the same time, we have to make reservations somewhat in advance. And so if you're interested in going on that trip and would like a little bit more information or just to put your name on a list, please do that this week. I'd like to kind of finalize the number this week and get ready to call Delta Airlines on the phone and ask them, you know, if I have 300 people coming to the Philippines, can you get me a, you know, kind of a deal on each of the tickets? And I know there's not going to be 300, not that foolish. But just to say that, if you're interested in going, my number is 573-216-2148. And I'd love to hear from you, and we can sort this out. We've come to part 9 in our... That was me. We've come to part 9 in our series entitled Beginnings. We've started kind of a marathon through the book of Genesis. Part 9 is the beginning of salvation from Genesis chapter 8 and 9. The last couple of weeks, you've been looking at the story of Noah. Actually, last week we did a Be the Church thing, but the 2 weeks previous to that when I was gone, you were looking at the story of Noah. That very first part of the story was the beginning of God's regret, where God looks at the world and is no longer pleased, cannot be pleased with what he's seeing in light of the way man is responding and reacting to the world around him. By the time we get to chapter 7, God has already told Noah that it's time to build the ark, and Noah is going to spend more than 100 years building this big boat, and in case you hadn't caught on to it, in a place where, well, there's no real access to any big waterways, at least as far as we know. And even if you were to build it on the shore of a great waterway, there is no way to move a 450-foot-long boat from the shore onto the waterway if you're living in Noah's day. Even with a couple of D9 Caterpillar tractors, I'm quite sure we couldn't accomplish something like that. It was an odd place for man to be. It was an odd thing for Noah to do. The beginning of God's regret in chapter 6, the beginning of judgment in chapter 7. And this is all by way of describing how God is responding to man's sin. How God is responding to what man has done with planet Earth up until that point. And we read there as the men taught through those two chapters that, oh, we're going through Genesis there, that the men taught through those two chapters these words, every thought of man's heart was only evil continually. God went on record that he would no longer exercise patience with mankind. It even talks about the intents of his heart, every thought of his heart and every intent of his heart, everything that he did and every motivation that he held. That is an incredibly powerful statement. What God pictures is that every single person on planet Earth is spending all of their time doing one of two things, either doing something wrong or planning to do something wrong. You know, you've got to take some time off, but that was the pursuit. Only evil continually. That's what God says about man and mankind during that time. And God goes on record with Noah to say that he's no longer going to exercise patience. He's going to give man 120 years. 120 years. And at the end of the 120 years, he tells Noah, I'm going to send a flood. I'm going to destroy life here on planet Earth. And I don't know how you feel about that. I don't know what your gut reaction is to that, because we have God pictured as being a God of love and mercy and grace, and absolutely, unquestionably he is. Unconditional love, unlimited grace, undeniable mercy. There is no question about that. But God is more well-rounded than that. And there are aspects of God's character that he wants us to understand this morning. One of the things that he's very powerfully pointing out is that he hates sin. In the midst of his love for us, in the midst of his mercy, in the midst of the grace that he exercises, he hates sin. And at one thing that we get from the book of Genesis, if we don't get it from anywhere else, not only does he hate sin, but he punishes sinful people. And I realize that's not a terribly politically correct thing to say, but I believe that God's character and nature can support itself. God can defend himself in these actions that he's about to take. And so every thought is only evil continually. And we need to be clear about this. God has decided that he will no longer exercise patience. Please understand that that does not mean that God's patience has run out. That's an entirely different topic. God's patience never runs out. It is absolutely limitless. There's no question about that either. And we don't want to get the idea that God started an experiment when he put man into the garden, when he put mankind on planet Earth, that he started an experiment and now he's somehow surprised that his experiment has failed. Poor God. He had such a good plan and it just kind of all fell apart. God wasn't dropping man onto planet Earth to see what we would do. You know, like we sometimes, you probably never do this. We do this in the Philippines. My own grandson, when he was, for his 10th birthday, asked for a spider box. Anybody know what a spider box is? You make it out of, by taking those old matchboxes that we used to have, you know, the ones that slide out and make drawers. You glue a bunch of those together. And then you can open those little tiny drawers and catch the spider that you've caught and put it down in the drawer and close it. And then you and your buddies, you all have spider boxes. His buddies over there, they all have spider boxes. And so they get together on a regular basis. They pull out this particular drawer because he knows this is one mean dude of a spider. He'll pull that spider out of there and he'll drop it onto a stick. And the other guy drops his onto a stick and they fight. It is so cool. I don't want us to get the idea that that's what God was doing. Let's just put man down there on planet Earth and see how this... Oh, my goodness, look at the mess he's made. That's not how it worked. This was not a failed experiment on God's part. God was not surprised, and his experiment had not failed. Instead, man had succeeded in wandering as far away from God's purpose for him as he possibly could. We wandered from what God intended. Do you remember from the first couple of Sundays that we spent together studying the book of Genesis, we laid out in careful detail what God's purpose for man was. Do you remember that? He makes everything in all of creation. He plants a garden and sets it up. And then he says in counsel with the Trinity, let's make one like us. Let's make something that will bear our image. That was man's true purpose. That's why man was put here on planet Earth, to bear God's image and to be like God. And by the time the days before the flood unfolds, not only have we missed the mark, we were designed to bear God's image. And in the years before the flood, it wasn't a question of mankind missing the mark, deviating from the standard slightly. It wasn't. In fact, man was not only not hitting the target, he's actually shooting in the opposite direction. That's where all of his life and everything, that he's no longer caring about bearing God's image. He's no longer caring about living out his purpose. And that was true of every single person on planet Earth with one exception. A man named Noah. One exception. Noah finds grace in the eyes of the Lord because he is a man who is training his children, a man who is listening to God and taking God at his word and passing on to his children all of the things that are in his heart as he discovers more and more who God is. But we have to say that given the course of events in human history right prior to the flood, I have to say personally, as I study it and look at it, if God had continued to tolerate man's behavior, if God had stood back and decided to patiently wait, if he had continued to tolerate man's behavior any longer, he would have been open to a charge of being dishonest to himself, to his own holiness, to his own righteousness, to his own standard that he had set for planet Earth. He had to act, and he had to act decisively. I talked with some folks this week who remarked at how surprised they were at how long Noah spent building the ark. Were you surprised at that? It's one of those things that you don't pick up in the typical reading. One of the things that we tend to miss is how long he was building the ark. The other thing we're going to point out today is how long he was aboard the ark. During the course of time after he had been shut in there with all those animals. And we can only imagine what the ark was like in terms of aroma and other things. But it was a long time. He spent years building the ark. He remained faithful. And he remained on task despite the fact that it had never rained. Did you pick that up as well over the last couple of Sundays? God has told Noah that water is going to fall out of the sky. And I know how you feel about that, especially after this week, right? Water fell out of the sky. But prior to Noah's day, there was no rain. The plants on planet Earth were watered by this mist that came up from the ground, this water that came up from the ground. That's how the plants were watered. And we tend to believe, though I'm not going to risk my life on it, we tend to believe that there was a canopy of water that actually covered planet Earth, a literal greenhouse effect. And so when God came to Noah and said, it's going to rain, God was predicting, prophesying, promising something that had never, ever happened. During the 100 years that he built that boat, more than 100 years, it never rained once. You suppose Noah had those moments during the course of that time? I mean, I know his wife was an awesome lady, but oh my goodness, I know what my wife would be doing. Somewhere around year 75, she'd be taking me aside and saying, you know, I remember you had sausages that night. I think maybe that's what we're dealing with here. Can you imagine? We have no record that God spoke to Noah between the time he told him to build the ark and the time he told him to get in it. More than 100 years, this man stays on task. Do you begin to grasp what it is that God has seen in this man, Noah? More than 100 years he remains faithful and he remains on task. He keeps doing what God has asked him to do, even though there is no precedent for the thing he is preparing for. We tend to salt away money. You know, if you've been to Financial Peace University, I forget how many months you're supposed to have in advance. I tend to run out of money before I run out of months, but I'm just one of those guys. But they tell us, you know, you could get sick, and so you should put some money in savings, right? And because we know that people have gotten sick, we make preparations. You know that you could get sick. I mean, forgive me for that. I don't wish that upon you, but we know. It's not easy to put away money, but we do against an eventuality that we've seen happen in the lives of other people. But Noah is spending more than 100 years getting ready for something to happen that he has never seen happen. It doesn't happen the entire time he's getting ready for it. There's no record in history that rain had ever fallen. We don't know how many conversations God had with Noah. We don't know if he came to the end of himself at year 37. I don't know. But he stayed on task. And he kept building. And after more than 100 years at the beginning of chapter 7, which you studied last week, God spoke to Noah again to tell him that the moment has finally come to gather his family together and to gather two of every kind of unclean animal and seven of every kind of clean animal and get on the ark. Could I suggest something to you about that particular moment? If you stop and think about it, there was only one thing that would have looked stupider than building the ark. And that would have been getting into the ark with all of the animals and everybody in tow. Let's all get in the ark, Noah says. Why? Oh, yeah, I remember now. Because water is going to fall from the sky. Oh, what a stupid old man. What do you suppose Jay Leno would have done with him? Or Jimmy Fallon, or worse yet, David Letterman. Oh, my goodness. Would he have had to stop building 50 years in to just go and have an interview with Jay Leno? I don't know. But it would have been in the news. It would have gotten to be old news. Yeah, he's still, yep. And then other news, Noah's still building his boat. So he gets into the boat. And the door shuts. He's there with his wife and with his family. And it's not stupid. Do you know why it's not stupid? Because it's an expression of his faith. He believes God. He has taken God at his word. And because he's taken God at his word, he's about to have an experience that is more unlike anything he's ever had than he ever anticipated. Because as God shuts the door and his family huddles inside that ark, can you imagine the moments after the door was shut? Can you imagine the looks that they must have exchanged between each other? You sure about this, Noah? And you and I have all heard it. It happened just this past week when we had that heavy rain. I walked out of my office into this main room here, and I was glad we were not here trying to do church. Because I couldn't hear anything. It was loud. Rain hitting that tin roof. And as they gather together and stand there looking at each other, who knows what's about to happen, they say. And then this noise starts on the roof. It sounds like water falling out of the sky. It begins to rain, and then it begins to pour. And according to the Genesis record, the floodgates of heaven are opened. I don't know if you've been by the dam recently when Alan Sullivan and company down there opened those floodgates, and the floodgates in heaven are open. The only thing I can imagine that means is that water that was being suspended, God has opened the door and now it's begun to drain. And the fountains of the deep begin to erupt. And I try to imagine what it would have been like as they stood there in that ark, huddled together, listening to all of this terror outside as people began to scream and wail. And then that first creak and the crack as the water surrounds the ark and it begins to lift up. It begins to be picked up by the currents. Can you imagine? You imagine the passion of that moment, looking at one another, wondering how this was going to turn out. What kind of looks were exchanged between Noah and his wife? As he looked at his sons and his sons' wives, what was going on in the ark as it rises? A number of years ago, I was on a particular airplane. I'd come from Mongolia via China and landed in San Francisco, and we were taking off from San Francisco, and I was supposed to go to Denver and from Denver to home, and I was really looking forward to that, well, to Springfield. You know, they don't allow them to land on Outback Loop over there. So, but we took off. We did the same thing we'd always done, this takeoff run, and the plane gathers speed. And right there at the end of the runway, when the plane is absolutely the most vulnerable, the right engine sucked something into it. We're not sure what it was. But there was this burst of fire that came out of the back of the right engine, and the plane dipped. I have no idea why the wing didn't touch the ground. It was that severe, that frightening. Pilot fought with it and got it back up and in place and immediately announced that we're having some difficulties. Thank you. I thought this is the way you always do takeoffs. Remind me not to ride with you next time. We're having some difficulties, he says. And we're going to go back to San Francisco. The flight attendants will keep their seats. And so we sat there. And you know how you can feel when a plane turns? Now, he wasn't going to mess with that airplane at all. He didn't know what he was dealing with. And so you couldn't feel the plane turn. And so we're all sitting in the back there waiting for the plane to turn so that we can go back to San Francisco. And there's no dip in the wings at all. And the only thing I can think is that, boy, I've seen this in the movies. They're up there just scrambling and not telling us what's going on. We're on the way down. And I looked at the lady that was sitting there next to me. There was a seat between us. Never met this lady before in my life. She reached her hand out, and I took her hand. Was it like that for Noah and family? Oh, they'd had the instructions, and they built the ark to the best of their ability. Nobody'd ever built a boat that big before. But they did it in keeping with God had asked, and now it's been lifted up. And I don't know how you have it pictured, but we're talking about absolute torrents of water. I think personally it would have been terrifying. And what I don't want you to forget is that no matter what Hollywood has portrayed in this most recent movie, Noah was not a superhero. He was a guy like me. A guy like you. Who had just spent 100 years doing something that he believed with all his heart God had asked him to do. And now everything, the life of his family, the life of all creatures that live and breathe on planet Earth, is in his hands as that ark begins to lift up. What kind of looks went between them? What kind of family bonding took place in those few minutes? The storm continued unabated for 40 days and nights, and the floodgates of heaven remained open, and the fountains of the deep continued to surge. And we can only begin to imagine at this point how enormous the waves must have been. According to the Genesis record, whether you decide to accept it or not, according to the Genesis record, the waters exceeded the top of the tallest mountain by 15 cubits. So there's no land on planet Earth to abate the waves. What kind of havoc was going on as they ride out the waves in this boat? And that little family clung to one another and continued to trust their God to protect them even in the midst of the storm. And I wonder this morning as I'm standing before you, if we were to sit down quietly over a cup of coffee, over a cup of life, and I were to ask you if anything like this has ever happened to your family, you could look at me and say, yeah, well, we've pretty much never been in an ark with two of every kind of animal on planet Earth. I understand that. But I wonder if you've ever been in a place where the storms kicked up. Not out at sea. But when your heart goes looking for refuge and peace and safety, the storm starts. And more than a week, it goes on. Things beyond your control. Things that you would wish would never happen to anyone are now happening to you. And it falls to you, Dad, to take care of Mom, and for Mom to take care of Dad, and these little ones that are along for the ride. Has it ever happened to you? Have you ever known troubles to flood into your lives with such force and intensity that you felt completely out of control? Have you ever gotten to the place in your life when you wondered, there, maybe God has forgotten you? A loving and generous God, a gracious God, who could snap his fingers and fix whatever's going on in your life. And yet for some reason, he doesn't. And he asks you to go through another week, and another week, and another week in the midst of the storm. You ever gone through a time when, well, it's just one of those days, I guess, becomes, well, I guess it's just one of those weeks. Which becomes, I guess, it's just one of those months, stop me when you've caught on to what I'm trying to say here. I know people that instead of saying, have you ever had one of those days, they look at you and say, have you ever had one of those lives? And I want to say, yeah. Because not everything is as I would choose it to be. So I get that. Has it ever happened to you? This morning, we want to pick up the story in chapters 8 and 9. And I want you to pay careful attention as the story begins to the first three words. I've never given you this kind of permission before. Listen to the first three words, catch on to what they are, and then you can just take a nap until I'm done with the story. But I want you to understand the first three words. And the reason that I want you to hear the first three words of this story that comes from Genesis chapter 8 and 9 is because those three words have powerful bearing. They have the potential to have powerful bearing in your life today. In your life this week, this month, as you try to sort things out. So I'm going to ask you to listen as I tell the story from Genesis chapter 8 and 9. You can certainly fact check me. But with that background, this is the story from God's Word. God remembered Noah. And took account of the fact that his family and all of the animals were there in that ark, had gone there for protection as God had designed. And over the course of 40 days and 40 nights, it continued to rain unabated. The windows of heaven were open, the floodgates of heaven were open, and the fountains of the deep were surging. And at the end of 40 days, God stopped the rain. And he closed up the fountains of the deep and he shut the floodgates of heaven. And the ark continued to flow. After 5 months, God generated a powerful wind. And that wind began to dry up the water that was all over the face of the earth. And in the seventh month, the middle of the seventh month, the ark came to rest, ran aground on Mount Ararat, even though you couldn't see it at that point. By the end of the 10th month, the tallest mountains, the water had abated enough that the tallest of the mountains were visible. Noah waited 40 days after the end of the 10th month and sent a raven out into the air. He opened the window that he had made in the top of the ark, and he sent a raven out, and the raven began to fly, and it flew back and forth, and it didn't return. And so he sent out a dove. And the dove fluttered here and there, not being as skilled a flyer as a raven is. It fluttered here and there, and then finally returned to Noah. He pulled it back into the ark and closed the window and waited 7 more days. And at the end of the 7 days, he sent the dove out again, and it returned this time with an olive branch, an olive leaf in its mouth. And so Noah closed the window again and waited another 7 days. And at the end of those 7 days, and if you're keeping count, we're well over a year at this point. At the end of those 7 days, he opened the window again, and he sent the dove out, and the dove flew, and it didn't return. And after more than a year confined in that ark, God spoke to Noah again. He said, Noah, it's time to come out. God opened the door, and Noah and his family and all of the animals that were with him stepped out for the first time on dry ground, the first time in more than a year. And the very first thing that Noah did was to find some rocks, some uncut rocks, and he made an altar. And on that altar, he offered some of the clean animals. You remember that the unclean animals went in 2 by 2, the clean animals went in by 7s. He offered the clean animals there on the altar, some of the clean animals there on the altar. And in response to that sacrifice that Noah was making in his effort to worship God, God spoke to Noah again and said, Noah, man is always going to be evil. But I will never again destroy the earth with a flood. As long as the earth stands, there will be springtime and harvest. summer and winter, day and night. And as an indication of my promise to you that I will never destroy the earth, I will set my rainbow in the clouds. And Noah trusted God again. That is the story from God's Word. More than a year in that boat. Did you catch those first three words? Those first three words of the story? What were they? Oh. Those may be the sweetest words that we've run across in the book of Genesis so far. After 100 years of work, after a year floating there in the boat, after all those times when Mrs. Noah must have turned to him and said, "Are you sure?" God remembered Noah. I want you to grab that. Put that in your back pocket for reference later this week. God remembered Noah. There are times when we wonder if God notices. There are times when we wonder if He's keeping up. When things begin to spin out of control and get incredibly difficult, we say to ourselves, I wonder if God knows. And I'd like to suggest to you today that no person in history has ever had more reason to doubt whether God is paying attention than Noah did. Floating. As he floated in that ark, riding out the storm. As he waited from month to month with no change in the routine. You suppose it was the end of the first month when Noah and his family felt that maybe God had forgotten them? Or do you think they got all the way to the end of the second month? Or was it the third? Please, I want to remind you again, Noah was a man like you. If you're a man. And Mrs. Noah?
Well, you're smart enough to figure that out.
I took a philosophy class a number of years ago in a place called Durant, Mississippi. They have offered it in the library. It was part of their continuing education program. I was reminded of it when we went to see God's Not Dead. And during the course of that philosophy class, the professor proved to us that there was no God. At least according to his estimation. There can't possibly be a God. He said that based on the fact that we assume that God is omniscient, which means that he's all-knowing, he knows everything, that he is omnibenevolent, which means that he is infinite in his goodness, and that he is omnipotent, which means he's all-powerful. We assume those things about God. And so the question he's asking is, how can you explain suffering in the world in light of a God like that? When a child somewhere on planet Earth is suffering, an all-knowing God would know about it. An omnibenevolent God, an infinitely good God would want to do something about it. And an all-powerful God would be able to do whatever he chose to do. And so when a child suffers and nothing comes to relieve that suffering, that can only mean that either God doesn't know about it, or he doesn't care about it, or he can't do anything about it. And he came to the end of that class with a bit of a smug smile on his face to show us, to prove to us, that according to this world's philosophy, forgive me, I'm an old man now. I'm at least a high mileage man. I've been around. And I have to say that philosophy professor isn't the first person I've known that's tried to tell God how to do his job. The problem with that kind of thinking is that in order to reach the conclusion that you can tell God how to do his job, you have to believe that you're smarter than God. I love the picture of that guy. I hope it's not one of you that was posing for something. But he looks smart, doesn't he? But in order to come to the conclusion that you know how God should do his job better than God does, you have to begin to believe somewhere along the line that you're smarter than he is. Which is a rough premise to start with. That you somehow have the capacity to know what's best when God clearly does not. And the truth of the matter is, if you forgive me for this, if you've been paying attention as we've studied Genesis together, the truth of the matter is that God did something about suffering right there in the Garden of Eden. He created a place that was full of his goodness. There was no suffering. And man threw it away. You and I, we threw it away. We pulled the plug, not God. And the same is true of the flood. The flood was not Noah's fault. Has that occurred to you? 100 years plus worth of building? More than a year floating there in that boat? And none of it was his fault. He was surrounded by a generation that had brought judgment on themselves. He found himself in the middle of that and was the one guy on planet Earth that wasn't to blame. And yet it falls to him to fix it. It falls to him to do the work. So since the flood is not Noah's fault, it must have been a real nuisance to him to have to build that ark, wouldn't you think? It must have been a real nuisance to him to have to float for an entire year. But I don't think Noah saw it that way. Do you know why? Because the only thing that would be more of a nuisance than floating for an entire year would be trying to tread water for an entire year. And I'm kind of thinking that Noah probably reminded himself of that from time to time. He might actually have been glad for the amount of time he spent that he invested in building that boat. And as soon as Noah's foot steps on dry ground, the first thing he thinks to do is to worship the God who had provided for his deliverance. That's the first step he takes. And God responds to that worship by placing that rainbow up there, an indication of his intention to keep his promise. And now 4,000 years have passed. 4,000 years have passed since Noah built that ark to save his family from the judgment that came upon that fallen world. And today we find ourselves in a world very much like the world of Noah's day. And just like Noah, God is calling us to build. To build a place of safety, a place of refuge from the floods and the storms that strike almost daily. To build a place where your spouse and your family and your friends, your children and your grandchildren, a place where we can retreat for refuge. And if you were here last week, then you know I am not talking about building a fortress where we can defend ourselves. I'm talking about a place of the heart, where it's safe to be. Surrounded by people who are riding together with us because they've built together with us. And what I'm trying to say is that all that building, well, it wasn't easy for Noah. And the seemingly aimless floating for more than a year probably wasn't very easy as well. But the end of that building was a new breath of life for all of mankind. And so I have to ask you this morning, how about you? What are you building these days? I look across our fellowship and I find lives that are in need of repair. Marriages that are in need of repair. Families that are in need of repair. Children and young people that are in need of repair. Hearts that are in need of repair. And yes, I haven't missed the point that my own heart needs that repair as well. I need to be surrounded by people who are willing to build into my life. And if we're honest about it, when it comes to all of that building, there's more to do than any of us can manage it on our own. So this morning, if you're intimidated by all that needs to be done, by all this building into one another's lives, by all the work that seems to be requiring, there's a video I want you to watch. It's about 3 minutes. Sit back. Enjoy.
This is Noah. He's 500 years old. Not bad. He doesn't look a day over 350. One day, God told him it was going to rain. No, not rain. It was going to flood. No, I mean really flood. God told Noah he needed to build something that could rescue his entire family and two of every kind of animal on the earth.
Let me see a football field. Okay, the ark was 1.5 times as long as that football field.
You built that? Not bad. It took Noah and his three sons 100 years to build this boat. It's 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. That's almost 1.5 million cubic feet. That's the capacity of 522 railroad cars. In the 20s, the Ringling Brothers Circus traveled with their entire operation, which included 335 horses, 26 elephants, and 16 camels, and they traveled in only 92 railroad cars. What I'm trying to say is, that's a big boat. Can you imagine starting with this and trying to get to that? Is it possible that following God means that we pursue crazy big dreams that seem humanly impossible? That maybe you and I are called to do things that everybody else would think is crazy, things that when we begin, we can't imagine where they ultimately end. We don't have to complete the journey today, but we have to begin to take the first steps, to drive the first nail. We pick up the first board, step out on faith, and we begin to trust God for the rest.
We're talking about a lot of building. You know, right outside those doors in the back there, there's a little sign on one of the walls that says Potter's Baby. Potter's Baby. 1 Corinthians 15 says, we shall not all sleep, but we will all be changed. And it is nowhere more true than in that particular room right there. We need people to build into the lives of the Potter's Baby. And we're having trouble finding volunteers. Room across from them is where the It's where the Potter's Toddlers meet. We got to change that name. That's too hard on a Sunday morning. I always say, give me a child until he's two. And then you can have him back until he's seven. Those toddlers need somebody to build into their lives, and we're having trouble finding volunteers. Then there's the Potter's kids and the Potter's youth who need somebody to build into their lives. And did I mention that we're having trouble finding volunteers? You look around you. There's lives that need repair. There's lives that need renovation, mine included. We need somebody who will be willing to build into us. And so we need to have small groups. We need to get our home huddles started again. We need to have an opportunity to speak powerfully into one another's lives. But that kind of building takes time and effort, and that kind of time and effort takes people who are willing to volunteer. And did I mention already that? Can I suggest something to you? Right outside those doors right there, there's a kiosk. And on that kiosk, there's a whole bunch of blank pieces of paper that have the name of a ministry over the top of it. I'm asking you to help us build. So when you go out, I was almost going to say, I don't want you to feel pressured, but I do. Go through those doors, hang a left or a right, depending on which door you go through. Stand there at the kiosk and say, I'm not sure what I'm great at, but I want to do something. Because in order, being involved is part of being the church. Or being the trutch, depending on what your t-shirt said last week. Volunteer. Okay? Will you stand with me in the presence? Our Father and our God, we bless your name today for the great kindness that you show us every single day, every single week. God, I know that I'm talking to people who are in need of repair, who sometimes say that this week is more than they can bear. And now I've just stood here, God, and I've said to them that you need to help others in the process. And I realize how overwhelming that might seem. But I pray, God, that you'd help us to remember that Noah spent all that time building and all that time afloat. And it might have seemed futile, but God, it was a good sight better than spending his life treading water. We don't want to tread water, God. Deliver us, we pray, and teach us to minister to one another. In Jesus' name, amen. God bless you. Have a good week. It's right out there. Just go volunteer. Sign up for something.